Live from Burbank, California, yay, the world's leading producer of fart-free beans, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, boil him in fennel seeds, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, people. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How is everybody? Man, I'm okay, Jim. I am okay. It's been quite a day for news, I believe, from where I'm looking at it, from where I'm seeing it from.
Woo, man.
A little bit.
Jam-packed with stuff.
Absolutely. The new press secretary, which we'll get to in just a minute, Tony Snow, they finally hired a guy who's not a bumbling fool, but instead a bona fide right-wing propagandist. Why mess around with it?
That's progress.
Just put a guy in there that's actually a professional. A guy who will just lie for the cause with confidence, as opposed to bumble through the lies and not really commit to them and then turn all red and, you know, choke up and stumble. Get a guy in there that knows what he's doing, that's hosted a radio show, that's misled millions already, and get him in there to respond to the press. They all know him anyway.
But he did call Bush incompetent, didn't he?
There's a long list of things that guy did, and that's an interesting conversation.
And the press corps is going to call him on that, and he's going to get frustrated and yell at them.
I don't know what he's going to do, but I question the politics of the choice because of how outspoken he is on Bush, because Bush is not a guy that entertains criticism at all. He's not a guy that shows any contrition for anything. And the fact that they hired a guy that has a history of being critical of the president on many levels is curious to me. Is it that they want to engage him in another in a fairly effective codependent relationship? Is this guy going to supposedly be the tough love the president needs as press secretary? I'm not sure what the politics are. We'll get to it in a minute. Let's set up the show. We'll speculate about it. From Raw Story tonight, we've got rawstory.com. Larissa Alexandrovna is going to talk to us about the dirty dealings and goings-on of some covert ops that are happening at the behest of Cheney and Rumsfeld in Iran, dealing with some Sunni terrorist organizations that are operating at behest of the Pentagon to
foment
unrest and cause trouble to get the thing started. That's not unlike they've done in many other situations like Vietnam, Iraq, on ad infinitum. The director of the very moving, very human, very engaging documentary Following Sean, Ralph Arlick, will be on the phone with us to talk about that film. Svetlana, our hooker / movie critic, will be here to talk about United 93. I just saw her walk in with, it's a little hot for a mink, but I guess she just came from a job. Also, we've got a call from Cindy Sheehan that came in yesterday. That was funny yesterday. We're about ready to pack up and leave the studio, and literally the phone rings, and Andy gets on the phone, and it's like, who? Cindy? And Bill and I are like, oh, it's Cindy Sheehan. Okay, put her on. And we run back in the studio and put the tape on. We got that kind of, is that ready to go, that clip at all? Can that happen soon? Can we do it? Yeah, we just checked in with, she called to say hi. She's a regular guest on Morning's Edition on my old show. And we just asked her what she was doing. Some of the stuff she said happened last night and will have happened by the time you heard this. But I got to be honest with you. It's always nice to hear Cindy Sheehan's voice. Hey, folks, on the phone right now with us is the premier anti-war activist in this country and a friend of mine and my old show and now the new show, Cindy Sheehan. It's great to talk to you again. Where are you?
Right now I'm in Los Angeles.
Okay, and can you just tell us, I just wanted to check in with you and let the listeners know what you've got planned upcoming and where they can come support the cause.
Okay, you know what we're all about, Mark, and it's so nice to talk to you again. I hope we get to talk more often.
Definitely.
But we and Gold Star Families for Peace, we're all about direct action.
Mm-hmm.
On this Thursday, we're going to go and confront the president again at the White House. We're coming up on the 2400th soldier. I'm just going to go and demand again a meeting with him. And we're going to see what happens from there. We're going to do a big action in front of the White House on Mother's Day.
We're going to do a
24-hour vigil. We're going back to Camp Casey in August. And on June 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, Gold Star Families for Peace are going to have a Camp Casey, Nevada, to protest the testing of the weapons that they're going to use on the country of Iran.
That looks like it's definitely going to happen, and that nuclear test is frightening to me. How far out are you guys? Are you going to go to the actual site, or where are you going to do the protests out there?
Well, we're going this week. My sister and a couple other people from Camp Casey are going to go scout out the site and see where we can camp and set up our Camp Casey. But we're going to try to get there as close as possible and, you know, just say not any more killing in our names. This is getting so scary and just beyond ridiculous. And we urge everybody to join us in Nevada to just stand up and say, you can't stop a country from getting nuclear weapons by nuking them. That's not right. And call for an end of all nuclear technology around the world. It's not okay for any country to have nuclear weapons. So we're going to be doing that. And if anybody wants information, they can go on our website, Gold Star Families for Peace.
I think it's great, Cindy Sheehan, too, that now, finally, some of the Democratic Congress and some of people like John Kerry and some of the senators are finally, you know, standing up and saying no to this war in a very real way. And I think all of America, given a few, you know, crazy, delusional people, are behind your cause and the cause to stop the killing in Iraq. And I think that is doing a large part to your efforts.
Well, Mark, we've come a long way since August, haven't we? But we sure have a long way to go. We can't let up now, and I really appreciate your efforts and your continuing support, of course.
Cindy, I'm so glad that you're doing well. You sound great, and thanks for giving us a buzz.
Oh, it's so nice to talk to you. I hope it's not too long in between times again.
Okay, Cindy, we'll get in touch with you soon.
Thanks, Mark. Love you.
Love
your
you
listeners.
Too. Okay, bye-bye. That was Cindy Sheehan yesterday. I tell you, Jim, she, if it weren't for her, there would be, she reinvigorated the anti-war movement, redefined it, reinvented it for the age that we live in now. And I feel a weird sense of pride. I like talking to her.
Yeah, I know. I can tell you do.
Yeah.
You know what the thing is, though? She kind of presents the comedian's dilemma.
Yeah.
You know, when is she going to do something stupid so we can make fun of her?
Well,
that's a real hard thing.
Well, the weird thing is that it's a lot of times now, it's not just about liberal politics, but in terms of doing the right thing and being a really truly righteous person, you don't want to make fun of them because that just automatically aligns you with the right in a way that it can't be anything but negative. A lot happened in the world today, and we want to make sure you're up to speed and informed. So here's tonight's edition of the Mark Maron Show, Short Order News. President Bush has named Fox News commentator Tony Snow to replace Scott McClellan as White House press secretary. The president gave a tour of the White House to Mr. Snow, showing him his flat-screen TV, his porn collection, and a red button that raises the price of gas in America when you press it. According to several top experts, including a leading U.S. government storm researcher, the record Atlantic hurricane season last year can be attributed to global warming. In response, a number of Bush appointees at the same conference suggested that changing wind and temperature conditions in the tropics are due to natural events like the rapture. Armed Sierra Leonean police are hunting up to 20 chimpanzees, which killed a local taxi driver and injured three American visitors after they broke out of a wildlife sanctuary. Since the chimps were wearing little red jumpsuits, eyewitnesses said the attack was tragic, yet absolutely adorable. And that's the Mark Maron Show Short Order News for this evening. So there's a lot of things I want to talk to Larissa about, but I find that sometimes when I say there's a lot of things to talk to the next guest about, I forget to talk about any of the things that I mentioned I'm going to talk about. But one of the things I might not get to is James Baker, i.e. Belial. Is that how you say the demon's name? I.e. Beelzebub's buddy.
Belial.
Any of them. James Baker, out of all of them. Man, this is the guy that Bush called in, that is daddy's buddy, the old Carlyle Group crony. This guy's been a Republican devil for years, and a fixer, is the guy that oversaw the 2000 recount, and now he's going to Iraq to oversee something over there, to poke his nose around. This is daddy reeling his boy in. Any time that James Baker arrives on the scene anywhere, he is the envoy from hell. He, to me, represents the devil. The guy, when everything gets really bad and they need something to save their evil asses, they're like, get Baker. So Baker's going to Iraq. We're going to talk to Larissa Alexandrovna in just a minute about Cheney Rumsfeld, maybe a little Baker, maybe tossing some Stephen Hadley and a little Death Squad Johnny Negroponte. We'll see. Hang out.
And now he just won't stop. Mark Maron.
That's it, huh? That was a short and sweet one. Thanks, Jim.
You're welcome, man.
Hey, folks, I don't know if you go to rawstory.com, but you oughta. Raw Story lives up to its title. It's a clearinghouse of alternative news stories and breaking news stories. I had no idea, but I could have assumed that Cheney and the neocon death cult were up to some shady business in Iran, sort of setting the table for the big finish of Western civilization. Here to tell us what is going on from rawstory.com is my old friend Larissa Alexandrovna. Larissa, welcome to my new show.
Thank you, and I'm really happy you have a show.
Yeah, we're on here in Los Angeles, soon to be on nationwide in many markets in the middle of the night where it's important, where we can actually reach out to people in waking consciousness so they don't know whether it's a dream or reality.
That's right. Infiltrate them.
Exactly. So let's start out with the front page at Raw Story today. Let's start with Rove. He's going back to testify before Patrick Fitzgerald's grand jury. Now, you guys have been saying that Rove's indictment is imminent for a while, and it looks like it might happen, yes?
Possibly. I mean, the problem is that predicting these things, things keep changing at the 11th hour, and deals and discussions are being made.
Mm-hmm.
The last information I had on Rove was that he was providing the email track to Cheney's office, the deleted emails. If you remember, they were suddenly found, like 250 pages.
Yep.
So he was providing that information. Now, how that's affected him now in terms of whether he's going to be indicted or not, I don't know, as I've literally jumped into the Iran stories.
Okay, well, we'll cover that in a second. One quick question before we leave the leak idea. I remember a while back we talked about Stephen Hadley, who is now National Security Advisor and was with Cheney during the leak. Is he out of the woods or what?
No. He's in the woods. But in that regard, there is literally no leaking other than he's Woodward's source. Other than that, there's really no discussion of him. And although he is named considerably in various filings as a key witness on both sides and
okay.
whatnot, or rather on the defense side, he really is. There's not much coming out about him. Although Jason Leopold, he and I covered some of this together,
he's the guy from Truth Out.
Right, he writes for Truth Out now,
yeah.
And he's done some fantastic work on this, and he's reporting that Rove has received a target letter. So it's quite possible, and he also reported that Hadley is to be indicted as well, so we'll see. I mean, I've sort of switched focus because of this other more
okay.
important thing going on.
Well, let's do that. Let's get to that right now. So let's tell us what the what's the down low on Cheney and Rumsfeld being low down in Iran. How what now? Explain to it in the best way so I can understand it and other people can understand it exactly what they are doing to create to set the table for war.
Okay. Well, I mean, from everything I understand, we are at war. If you think of dead bodies and bombings and violence as war, then we are at war.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several articles I've now published on this. One of them is that as we invaded Iraq, we secured a base that was being used by a terrorist group that was working for Saddam, and he gave them safe haven and a base and whatnot. And they're Iranian, they're former Iranians, they were living in Iraq at Camp Ashraf.
So this is a Sunni terrorist group?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing a lot of the policing for Saddam, so I think you know who the type of mentality we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
And they're also responsible for a lot of attacks on U.S. Facilities in Iran, and there were U.S. casualties and whatnot.
And this is the Mujahideen El Khalq.
Correct. I was going to get to that. Right. MEK is much easier to say.
Okay.
MEK. And we secured the base that they were staying at, and roughly 3,800 people.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, we took away all their big toys, but we left all their guns, and we let them literally just roam about. Because at that time, Paul Wolfowitz, who at that time was Deputy Secretary of Defense, wanted to use them in Iran.
So he had that. He was just following the neocon agenda, the Pax Americana, looking ahead, and he said, "We're going to need these guys. Keep them in the background."
Right. Well, the problem was the State Department. They were on the State Department's terror list, and they said, "Absolutely not. You can't use these guys." So they had been pushing against the State Department all this time,
mm-hmm.
and last year, what they finally came up with, this really sort of clever but really ugly way of doing things, is they simply had the MEK members resign and swear an oath to democracy, and they were no longer terrorists.
Okay.
And that's how they avoided using a terrorist organization, because those people all resigned, and so the people
So you're basically saying it's just semantics. They went through some sort of little ceremony. They quieted the leaders, and now they said, "You're working for us."
Right. I mean, essentially what they did was they put a new label on that's the same ingredient.
So now what are they doing in Iran?
They're doing bombings. They're doing, actually, the Sunni region and the Shia region as well. On one side, they're trying to stir up a grassroots uprising. On the other side, they're trying to implicate the Shia in bombing campaigns. And my understanding is that, although this has not been widely reported, just this past March, there were 22 casualties in one bombing event that these guys did.
So the tactic is that these guys are working, covertly at the behest of Cheney and Rumsfeld to foment some disturbances to make it look like there's an uprising or that
they're
okay. And this is opposed to Cheney and this administration saying that they're trying to find diplomatic channels to work. And you've got some proof that they are actually working against any diplomacy whatsoever.
Oh, sure. And this has been now confirmed since my article. The mainstream delay is no longer 6 months. It appears to be at a 2-week delay. And this has been confirmed. I mean, the Asia Times just ran its own investigative piece on this. And the Iranians have long been saying they suspected America was behind this. Obviously, given the insanity of some of their leadership, it's hard to believe them on anything. But
it's horrible. It's not good news, but it's not unlike what America has done historically in terms of sending military advisors or creating chaos so they can then invade.
Well, sure. I mean, we created Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and now look what they've become. They've
absolutely
grown up to be our enemy.
Larissa, it's so good to talk to you again. Can we do it again soon?
Yes.
Okay, I'll talk to you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Larissa Alexandrovna. Raw Story is the place to go, .com, to read all her articles. We're going to be back. We're going to talk to Ralph Arlick about Following Sean, a very moving documentary. Stay with us.
And now he'll carpet any home, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Now we're going to switch gears from the foreboding, apocalyptic realities that Larissa Alexandrovna shared with us. Man, you got to read some of that stuff. I mean, it gets complicated, and it's hard to kind of sort through a lot of the Sunni Shia tribal allegiances, a lot of the politics of Iraq that goes beyond our presence there. And it's just awesome in how horrifying the possibilities are. Let's move on from that for now. In the late 60s, filmmaker Ralph Arlick was living in the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco trying to figure out who he was and where he was going. He was 25 years old during that period of dramatic cultural change. And in the midst of all that counterculture chaos, a 4-year-old who was living in the communal apartment upstairs with his family and whoever else wanted to crash up there would wander down to Ralph's apartment to chat. He was the prototype for the hippie kid, and Ralph began taping this kid, Sean. The short documentary that came out of those sessions drew international attention and was used by some to negatively characterize the entire youth movement of that era. Many things have changed since then, and Ralph Arlick went back to find Sean in San Francisco and Sean's family. This is 30 years later. The result of that search is the new film Following Sean. Welcome to the show, Ralph.
Thanks a lot.
I'll tell you, I your movie, a lot of levels, and there's so much in it, it's going to be hard to focus for me to talk about. It's about a nation growing up. It's about Sean growing up. It's about you growing up, facing your own mortality. It's a very rich human film. But let's start with the past and bring our listeners up to speed. Tell us what happened with the first film and how that came about.
Well, as you said, I was living in the Hate at the time. Mm-hmm. I hadn't gone there for, you know, to sort of find Nirvana or to for the Summer of Low or for any particular reason. I found myself in California, and rents were cheap in the Hate, and I found this apartment and moved in.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I was a film student at San Francisco State, and I needed a topic for a movie, and there was this wonderful kid who lived upstairs from me. He was bright and precocious, and I just loved spending time with him, and I thought, geez, he'd probably make a good subject for a film. So I sat him down on my couch one day and began to interview him, and then that's the way it started. I made this 15-minute black and white film about this kid in the Hate.
And it's classic that the what you capture in the current documentary and the old documentary was what you were living in was somehow a perfect little petri dish of what was going on in specifically San Francisco, certainly at that time. I mean, upstairs, Sean's dad had a wife. They had an open marriage. They had a lot of drifters coming in and out. There were drugs involved. And this kid was just this shining beacon of light, this shining beacon of innocence that probably knew more than he should have known at that time.
Well, he was exposed to a lot. I mean, that seems clear.
Yeah. And let me just ask you, how does a 15-minute film, how did your 15-minute black and white film get into the hands of, say, Francois Truffaut? How did it become sort of exploited by the right-wing faction of the culture at the time to indict the hippie movement? How did that happen?
Well, you know, once you make a film, you don't really have any control about how it's used. And, you know, I made this student film, and then I began entering it in film festivals.
Oh, okay.
And then, you know, it's out there. You know,
yep, yep.
It played at the London Film Festival with Truffaut's Wild Child, and he saw it, and he wrote me a very nice letter about it. And then, you know, it began being seen around the country. And then, you know, people are going to glom on to things according to their, you know, their biases. And if they want to prove something, they can use your movie or whatever you say as an example of the particular belief system.
Yeah, I know you had no control over that. It was interesting to me because for a 15-minute film to gather that much momentum now would take an awful lot, you know.
Yeah, well, I guess there was more of a market for shorts at that time than
mm-hmm.
Than there is now. I mean, shorts are still seen, but there are many fewer venues for them now.
Sure, you can see them online now. It's a lot easier these days, I guess, for
right.
filmmakers in that way. But what, you know, I'll tell you honestly, what I found really interesting about the film, and you know, as I said, I'm going to have a hard time talking about it because I watched it and I was very moved by it. Was that you had this amazing like a convergence of legacies? You had Sean's father, who was the child of a banker, child of the establishment. His mother was the daughter of a well-known, renowned American communist. Your parents were, you know, East Coast socialist dabblers. And the fabric that you wove about the working class establishment, the youth movement of the 60s, was very provocative. Now, I got to say, in watching the film, you did ultimately make the 60s look a little doofy, a little goofy.
Oh, did I?
No, I mean,
I feel like I've betrayed part of my heritage. You know, I wouldn't characterize it that way, although obviously you can draw your own conclusions,
well,
but I think I felt ambivalent about it, and I think a lot of people at that time felt ambivalent about it because it was both just this incredibly exhilarating and wonderful moment, but there was also a lot of dogma and crap, and sort of in some ways you often felt like you had to toe the line.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt, you know, I felt ambivalent about it. It was very exciting, but it was also, you know, it had its own kind of rules and things that you sort of felt that you had to follow.
But those rules, it was interesting because those rules really revealed themselves more so than not as trends and almost peer pressure, a cultural peer pressure.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
It was
peer pressure, and that's not new and that's not unique to the 60s, but I guess a lot of us felt it strongly at that time because sort of the dogmas that were coming out were kind of different, you know. They were sort of, I guess you felt they had legitimacy because we hadn't heard them before, so you kind of felt that you were sort of swept up in this in the movement.
I was born in 63, and I grew up sort of, with a lot of reverence, feelings of reverence for the 60s and the people that I still feel that way about some of the iconoclastic personalities and creative minds of the 60s. The thing, I don't think that you did anything intentionally, but what was interesting when you were sort of pitting, kind of juxtaposing your family and your father's work ethic and his open-mindedness on some degree with Sean's grandfather's, you know, communism and just the idea of what the working class really meant. And then you see all this hippie movement, and they're supposed to be a revolution, and they don't want to do anything. That the constant cutting back to, the hippies in the pond and dancing around and standing on their head, you really began to feel like, wow, that what did that really mean other than just standing on your head, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, I think I wouldn't characterize it exactly the same way, because I think, you know, I think whatever you feel about whether Sean's grandparents and their communism was dogmatic, one thing that struck me while making the film is that in every generation in Sean's family, whether it was hippies or communists or whatever, they really did it.
Yeah.
And that, I think that, and I think one of the things I was trying to allude to in the film is that whereas my family were more like most of us are, observers, you know, we sort of absorb what's ever happening culturally at a particular time, and we probably not in it up to our necks the way
right.
Sean's family was. And I think that's what I was trying to say about my own parents, you know.
They were great.
I loved them as much as I did, you know.
Yeah.
They sort of dabbled in left-wing and communist politics. They didn't do it the way Sean's family did it, which is always to the hilt.
Sure, yeah. And there's also a difference between the sort of Eastern Jewish socialist movement and the social scene that revolved around that. I thought it was beautifully captured in that the scene with your parents and some of their friends reflecting on the meeting. In the camps.
Yeah,
up.
Yeah.
It was really touching. Hey, so let's get to Sean, because I don't want to tip too much about the film. I'd like people to see it with a certain element of suspense. But where I was surprised, because when I first started watching the film, I'm thinking to myself, how's this kid going to turn out? And you're going to make these judgments, you know, before you actually see Sean, you know, 30 years later, having those parents and coming up in that environment. Now, were you surprised with how he turned out?
Yeah, I was, but you know, in retrospect, I probably shouldn't have been, because I think you get a sense when the film starts with sort of clips from the original movie. You see the original movie was 15 minutes, and you see about half of it in the course of the
mm-hmm.
documentary feature. And I think you get a sense, I mean, just from those the way he was at 4 years old, a kind of self-assurance that's, you kind of know that it's going to stand him in good stead eventually. And I personally feel that actually, you know, I think the film, one of the things the film does is sort of, it looks at the whole question of freedom and whether freedom is always a good, and whether, you know, giving kids a lot of freedom is good. But I think you can see that Sean in many ways benefited from the freedom that he was given. It gives him a certain self-assurance and ability to make his way in the world.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it also brings up questions about, you know, what freedom is, because when you're juxtaposing cinematically, you know, a four-year-old running around the hay with no sneakers and a 20-year-old, you know, standing on his head in Golden Gate Park, you know, high on dope, it was kind of interesting about, you know, what does freedom mean and how do we use it, and what are some of the things that make this country great on some level. It's a very deceptively complex, very human film. And I tell you, like all good documentaries, it doesn't really, offer any answers as much as it does provoke questions. And I felt that a lot of this film, Ralph Arlick, was some sort of journey for you. Did you get some closure in making this movie?
That's a good question. They're not therapy, and I don't think they give you closure. But I think it did. I don't know. I think it did reveal some things to me. I mean, one of the things, as I was saying, is the degree to which I, like many of us, am an observer. I mean, I think that was one thing that I learned in the course of it. I guess it did. I did sort of come to terms a little bit with my ambivalence about the '60s, with both the real feelings of pleasure that I had about that time, and also the feeling, the misgivings that I had about it.
And everything's okay with you and your wife? You guys are all right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, good. Hey, you know, it's a very intimate film. You're going to get these kind of questions.
Right.
All right. Well, I enjoyed it, Ralph, and I wish you the best of luck with it.
Well, thank you. I really have enjoyed talking with you about
okay,
it.
Okay, take care, Ralph Arlick. The film is Following Sean. It's in theaters now. See it if you can. It's a subtle movie, but it's very revealing and very human, and it was a great experience to see it. We'll be back with Svetlana is here, and she's taking her mink off in the studio. Okay, see you in a minute.
And now he's just following orders. Mark Maron.
No, I'm not, man. I'm fighting the man. I'm fighting the man. I'm taking the fight to the man, to the streets,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, those were your orders.
Hey, that's... What?
Those were your orders.
Oh, now you're screwing with my head, dude.
Yeah, man.
Oh, you're twisting it up, man.
Oh, yeah.
I'm all messed up. So right now, people, as usual, our regular... She's a regular guest now because she's so damn good at what she does, both things that she does. She's our movie critic, and of course, she's an old hand at entertaining. She's our prostitute / movie critic. And she's not ashamed of that. Svetlana has...
Maxima Schultz.
I'm never going to get
you're
that.
You're doing great, Mark.
I'm never going to get
you're
that.
You're a polyglot, truly. Really.
So how are you?
I'm doing fantastic,
did
Mark.
Did it happen last night? What happened?
Well,
did you
I went on my first date in 5 years.
Oh, congratulations.
It's a big deal. Thank you. Thank you. You have to understand, Mark, I don't get out much. People usually come into me.
Uh-huh.
You like
sure?
that little
yeah.
fun? You like? I know you like fun. He's the fun master. The point is, Mark, prostitution limits your nightlife. You know, it limits your nightlife. It's very embarrassing to go to movies and see 14 clients there with their wives and children. So I stay in. I keep it simple.
Sure, sure.
But I was at Target yesterday buying a... the fuzzy toilet seat. I always wanted one of those.
Yeah, yeah.
The fuzzy toilet
they
seat.
They don't have those in Russia?
No, not so much. It's more plastic and steel.
Oh,
cold
okay.
steel appliances.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This very handsome gentleman came up to me and said, would I like to go to movies with him?
Uh-huh.
And I said, of course, $40 to take me to movies, $55 with manual activity. You know how it works.
Yeah.
But he said, no, you don't understand. It's press screening for United 93. You know
so,
this movie?
Oh, so this is the movie you went to see. I knew you were going to go. I just wasn't sure if you
it
went.
It was between that or Inside Man, which we saw last week. I went to see again for Clive Owen's buttocks. But I said, you know what? And I said to him, I said, 1993, what kind of idiot takes hot date to movie about September 11th?
Yeah, no
oh,
kidding.
You're so nice and hot. Let's go see Hotel Rwanda. I mean, it's a putz, right?
Yeah.
But I said, you know what? I'd already seen the Big Love episode last week. I said, you know, go out on a date.
Uh-huh.
Have fun. Live life.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah, I would, yeah.
So last night, for 2 hours, we tortured ourselves, reliving what it is like to be on this flight. Every horrifying moment.
Yeah.
Minute to minute torture.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Gulag is Disneyland compared to this movie.
So not a comfortable movie.
No, that is understood. Right?
Yeah.
And at one point, of course, you know, the passengers attack the terrorists.
Sure,
right?
Yeah,
this woman behind me starts clapping and cheering. I get so angry, I throw popcorn on her and beverage.
No.
I said, what do you want? This is Harrison Ford movie. You think Jake Gyllenhaal is going to come out of cockpit with Kirsten Dunst and say, thank you for saving me? Idiots.
Yeah, that's true, because we know how it's going
to
end.
It's sad. It's sad. It's not like cheer. Oh, you know, I have to tell you, Mark, though, this was a hard movie for me to see for many reasons beyond the obvious ones.
Uh-huh,
I have seen the decline of these people. I'm talking about the terrorists.
Really?
Yes. You may not know this about me, Mark, but I was a big hit on the Afghan circuit back in 89.
No kidding.
I brought my girls to give local boys sexual release.
Uh-huh,
it's a smart business move. I mean, they're young boys, no direction in life, too hung up on tradition, you know, and the local girls weren't cutting it.
Uh-huh.
You're actually talking
about the Afghanis.
The Afghanis and the other people, the Lebanese, whoever was coming for training at that point, all the surrounding areas.
Yeah,
the
it's hard to know. Sure, sure.
All look the same to me. I'm sorry. I'll be honest. People say that about me, say it about Asians. I don't care. But they all look somewhat, you know, very.
Okay,
ethnic.
All right. But you're there to service whoever needs to be
they
serviced.
Need
so you, yeah, you're not judging.
Yes,
on
no,
that level.
No judging.
Right,
business
right.
is business.
Okay.
And I was a youngster then. I didn't know what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just say I got involved with a particular boy at the time. He's a tall, lanky fellow, broad shoulders, severe abandonment issues. Of course, I'm talking about Osama bin Laden.
No.
Yes, I called him Sammy back then.
Wow.
Yes, yes. Now remember, Mark, this was before he became hardcore extremist. He was still thinking about career in marketing, maybe mortgage lending. He was talking about dental assistant position. This is before he had the change of heart.
So he's sort of a weekend warrior then.
Well, he was up and coming in the ranks, but he was still thinking, let me go something stable.
Uh-huh,
you know, stable career for family. And I have to say, Mark, just between you and me and anyone who happens to be an earshot, best lover ever had.
No.
Yes. The sensuality. The beautiful long hands. Magic fingers. I said, Sammy, you have magic fingers.
Wow.
I said this to him. I did. He appreciated it.
Uh-huh.
So attentive. Svetlana, what do you like? What can I do to make you feel good? Touch you here. Touch you there. Fantastic. Fluent in Russian, by the
really?
Way. Of course.
Uh-huh.
Of course.
Yeah.
Afghanistan. Of course.
Yeah.
Fluent in Russian.
Uh-huh.
You know, quoted Pushkin to me, almost quietly better than my Uncle Vlad ever did. He really did.
Oh, no.
And it was a very passionate affair, Mark. And this is hard for me because it's personal stuff. And you know me, I'm usually very business, but this was a difficult...
It's making me a little uncomfortable.
I can feel the tension in the room. He had this mystique, and I got caught up in the moment.
Uh-huh.
You know, but the more we hung out, the more I learned of his beliefs and his views, just didn't seem that attractive to me anymore.
Uh-huh.
I have standards, Mark. I don't sleep with anybody.
Sure, sure.
Almost, but not everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
So I took my girls and left. We had a little, you know, farewell shindig in the cave. You know, basics,
man.
Pickles, pita, Irina made a casserole. It was very emotional. And he was heartbroken. I mean, the letters I would get from this guy, love you forever, Osama. Come back, your Sami is waiting. Life has no meaning without you. It was horrible for years.
I'm starting to get the feeling that the bitterness of losing you might have caused
it
us.
Don't give me that response, because I had nightmares about that, Mark. My father called me. He said, it's all because of you. Bastard whore. He said, I said, I am a whore, but I'm not a bastard. You're alive. So anyway, he started getting jealous and nasty. He said, heard you with Matt Dillon last night. Does he touch you the way I touch you? Does he give you, do you give him a discount? That one was really stung, Mark. Really stung. I finally wrote back. I said, you know what? Sama, you're becoming a monster. Leave me alone. But he couldn't. It was an obsession.
Oh, man.
In fact, I got an email from him last week.
Get out of here.
I brought it. Do you want to hear it, Mark?
Yeah.
I did bring it. Here,
you brought an email from Osama bin Laden.
I printed it out. I don't like to read on computer screen. I like to print out, and actually I write by hand, and I have somebody type it for
me. You know,
he
released a tape to the world, but he sent you an email.
We have more. Well, he tried tapes with me. I said, you know what? I have DigiBay. I have Betacam. What do you call the old system?
Right.
Betamax. Betamax.
What did he say on, the,
okay,
that, on this email?
Okay, here we go. Here, I have it here. Okay. Dear Svetlana, it's Osama. He's an idiot. Of course it is. Just so you know, I'm in Paris with my new girl, and she is much prettier than you and has nicer ass. Which I know is impossible, Mark.
Yeah.
We are eating chocolate croissants near Centre Pompidou and having good time. Take that.
Wow.
Such a child. It's a child.
Uh-huh.
It's a child. Oh, there's more here. Please come see me. I'm at 45 Rue de Saint-Germain at the Best Western. He was always a cheap schmuck. Always a cheap schmuck. I'll be here through Thursday. Love you forever, Osama bin Laden. Like I didn't know.
So you all right?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mark. The memories are flooding back.
Do you think maybe you should turn him in?
Well, Mark, you know, I try to do good in this world. You know, Svetlana can break hearts, but I am responsible citizen, and I am citizen.
Uh-huh.
I am legal citizen.
Uh-huh.
I called the vice president. Client, of course, client. And taught him about Sami's whereabouts. But he said, sorry, Svetlana, I can't very well send our people to Paris on just a hunch.
Mm.
Idiot.
Yeah, they don't know who they're dealing with.
Paris.
Yeah.
Paris, France, Pats.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mark, I have to go. I'm going to stay in and watch a movie tonight. I'm not going out on dates anymore.
No?
You know, something light and fun. Rick Santorum, client, recommended to me last week, House of Sand and Fog. He said it's a fun film.
Fun film.
He said fun for everyone.
So I guess ultimately what we've learned a lot today about you, and we've learned that the movie, United 93, actually tedious and hard to sit through.
Very hard to sit through. And what's the point? I mean, you know, it's not like we are illuminating issue that's not... Oh, the cabaret dancers are coming out
now.
Yeah,
do you want to dance
on
the break?
I'd like to. I'm wearing my little tutu.
I know you are. So why don't you hang out and do that, and we know where Osama is, and just, you heard it here first. Cheney said he didn't care, didn't believe Svetlana. We'll be back in a minute.
Live from Burbank, California, the world's leader in man bag theft. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he lives in the enchanted broccoli forest. Mark Maron.
Man, I gotta get back to the enchanted broccoli forest, my friend.
Your roots.
Are you going to find us a guest that we can talk to that supports your meat manifesto, your anti-meat manifesto?
I'm doing research on that.
Did you get that article I sent you from
yes,
Mother Jones?
I did.
About that guy, Michael Pollan, who was recommended to me by one of our blog rads on the blog?
Yes, I did.
Or no, you know what? I think it was actually sent to me in an email. Because I want you to be able to support your strangely veggie-fascistic...
Excuse me? What?
You're a veggie-fascist.
Veggie-fascist? Really? You know, I'm just thinking of others, which is something that, you know, obviously a novel idea here in the studio, but...
Is that true?
Yeah.
Is that really true?
Uh-huh.
I don't think so. I think that I think of other people all the time.
Yeah?
Yes, I think of other
and
people.
And how to make fun of their beliefs and ideas, sure.
Exactly, that's my job. That used to be your job, except when it's yours.
Biggest cliche in the world to make fun of vegetarianism.
I'm not making fun of vegetarianism. I'm making fun of the narrow-mindedness of your particular form of it. Now,
oh, horse, beep! and be.
All right.
See, I edited myself there.
That was very good. So there's a couple things I want to talk about, and I don't know if we. I don't understand this. That this guy, Tony Snow, who is a Fox radio commentator, a Fox News Channel commentator, gets the job, gets assigned to, or appointed to, White House Press Secretary instead of mushmouth Scott McClellan. And this is a guy, as I said before, who is a bona fide right-wing propagandist. It's his job. And now he is going to be the guy. It seems to me that most of the time, they hire people for press secretary that are kind of socially inadequate, not very charismatic, but this guy is a real spokesman for the right, and he is an outspoken critic of some of George Bush's policies and of George Bush himself. Now, this is published on a liberal blog. This is on the Center for American Progress put out some of the stuff that Tony Snow has said about the president, like Bush has, quote, lost control of the federal budget and cannot resist the temptation to stop raiding the public fiscally. He's also said that George Bush and his colleagues have become not merely the custodians of the largest government in the history of humankind, but also exponents of its vigorous expansion. He said that George Bush has become something of an embarrassment. He has said that no president has looked this impotent this long. He has said that Bush has given the impression that he is more eager to please than lead. I mean, this guy, Tony Snow, is now going to be the White House press secretary, is an outspoken critic of the president. Now, why would this president hire a guy that has publicly said that much negative crap about him? I'm trying to figure out what that means metaphorically or politically, and what his placement there could mean. Does it mean that they're actually putting a guy out front to deal with the press that has the guts to you know, talk down to the president or be critical of the president, and the president just engages in it? Is this some sort of, you know, pseudo codependent relationship that's supposed to make the press feel like they're getting the real deal? I don't understand what the angle on this is. All I know is that the guy who's going to now be talking to the press is a professional propagandist.
He's never going to tell the president the truth, and that's exactly why he hired him.
You mean he's never going to tell the president's truth? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, both, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Man, you're way over my head.
What are you talking about?
I don't know.
You said he's never going to tell the president the truth.
In those opinion articles right there. I mean, those statements. He's never going to tell the president that now. No, he's under the president's wing. That's exactly why the president hired him, I believe, because he'll use that expertise on the press, not on the president.
No, yeah, I think that's true. He hired him because he's a good propagandist.
It's more of the same. The president is, you know, Bush is never going to change the way he thinks. He just wants somebody else to harsher and better in show business to deal with the press.
Right. So it's a credibility issue. They're going to think that this guy's the real deal. They're going to give the press at least the fair shake, the straight scoop, the real deal, because he's got the guts to talk down to the president, which is a bunch of crap. Because as you're saying, you know, if somebody's going to take this gig, they've got to be on board with the program. But what his past enables him to present himself as is somebody who, you know, who is willing to speak his own mind and has his own personality. That's the illusion that they're creating here. And I think it is just that, obviously. The other thing I wanted to talk about before we bring Joel Spiegel in here, a couple of things that I think can lead up to what we're going to be doing with him. Now, this CD that he produces is great, and I'm not a hip hop guy. It's not that I judge hip hop. I just didn't lock into it as a kid because I wasn't a kid when it started happening necessarily, and it just never spoke to me. But this particular CD that he produced did. The CD is Voices from the Frontline. It's literally American soldiers who are fighting in Iraq and doing hip hop music and speaking about the war through rhymes and hip hop, and it choked me up a couple of times. But the way I want to lead into that somewhat is that I read an article today. This comes from the AFL-CIO weblog that for the first time in a decade, the national job fatality rate was up from the previous year. Apparently in 2004, this is the last year that they've got these numbers, 5,703 workers died from workplace injuries compared to 5,575 the previous year. And the sad part about this is the high number, obviously, of poor people, of poor workers, but the overall increase in death in deaths on the job are significant increases in the number of Hispanic and foreign-born workers killed. Now, alongside of that, these are obviously, you know, a lot of them either they may not be union, they may be union, but probably not. These are the disposable poor people of this country who are being injured and they are being killed on the job, and they are not. Because of this administration, because of tort reform, they are no longer enabled or can they sue corporations or companies, mm-hmm. you know, because there's a cap. There's no way that corporations or companies can be held responsible for these deaths, number one. Number two, if they are injured, most of them don't have health care, so they're going to go broke if they have any money at all. That's over for them. They can't declare bankruptcy because of this administration's new bankruptcy laws. And then what happens is if they are not working in these kind of conditions, which are unsafe and do not take care of them if they're injured, they are going to war. These are the same people that are going to war in Iraq. This primarily a poor, primarily a lot of Latino, a lot of African American people are compelled into the armed forces because of their class condition. And I just in a similar story, the suicide rate in the Army has increased. In 2005, a total of 83 soldiers committed suicide, compared with 67 in 2004 and 60 in 2003. And I think the reason why I'm talking about this before we bring on, I don't know what I was just calling him, but I apologize if I said his name wrong. It's Spielman. Is that right? Spielman? Okay, Joel Spielman. You know, I said Spiegel. Yeah, I should just say Joel, Jewish guy, is going to be here in the studio. Yeah, just Joel, Jew guy, is coming in to talk to me, another Jew guy, about show business, because that's what Jews do. We're in show business. How do you like that shift from suicide? I guess my point in transition, Jim, is that given the conditions, obviously in the work environment, and given the conditions in the armed forces in terms of poor people or people who have to be in these situations having a voice, it is minimal. And certainly we're seeing immigrants rise up and fight for their rights, illegal or otherwise, to be American citizens and to be treated fairly in the workplace. And as far as the military goes, you don't see much of this and you don't hear much of it because these guys aren't really allowed to speak out of school. So what you have with Joel CD, the one that Joe Spielman produced, Voices from the Front Line, is you have actual soldiers who are talking about their experiences and all the emotional experiences that they're having in Iraq when they go to Iraq. Now, I don't know if I would classify this CD as a protest album, because I don't know that it is. I think you're going to have to decide that. What it is it is an honest album from the voices of people that are there in it. And I don't see how you can really see it as anything but an anti-war CD from where I'm sitting. But you can also see it as a very human expression of the type of fear, pain, panic, heartache, and complete grief and horror that goes on from the point of view of a soldier on the ground through hip-hop. And we're going to talk to Joel, a Jewish guy, in just a second about his CD. Stay with us.
Back to Jew Guy host, Mark Maron.
Yes, thank you, Jim. That's
You're
very
welcome.
Nice coming from a guy who dyes his hair blonde and wears Lenin glasses.
What?
That's all you got?
That's
Come
all
on,
I,
bring it. Where's
man,
it?
You know, I just answer you with the truth, and that's all I have. That's the only weapon I have.
Did you listen to the CD? I got to give it to you. I'm sorry, I've kind of been hogging it.
No, I haven't had a chance to listen.
I'm
going to
give
yet,
it to you. The CD Voices from the Front Line reinvigorated my interest in hip-hop. I was never a big hip-hop guy, as I was saying. I never had anything against it, just never fully resonated with me. I tried. When I listened to this CD, though, I realized for the first time, really, what an effective delivery system hip-hop is for raw emotion. Voices from the Front Line is 24 tracks of hip-hops and interviews from soldiers in Iraq. Here to tell us about the creation of the CD is Joel Spielman. Did that it?
Yeah, you pronounced it right.
Spielman.
Spielman is the
Spielman.
Original pronunciation.
You know, mine's not even a Jewish last name. It's Marin, but I've all my life. Marin, Moran, Moron, Moran. Always. So now, let's. Who are you, and what compelled you to this project, Joel?
I run a medium-sized record label in Los Angeles. I started a few subsidiaries there. It's predominantly started as a punk rock label. I did a punk rock bands from Boston. I mean, that's what I was doing. And I saw a documentary on Veterans Day, believe it or not, in 2004.
Uh-huh.
It was called Last Letters Home. And I found some of it very poignant, where moms and dads were reading the last letters that their sons and daughters wrote before they were killed during Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Man.
And a lot of the letters they got before knowing that they were dead. So some of it was very poignant, and just something compelled me to do something where you were hearing the voices of soldiers and Marines, and to have it be as real and as current as possible, almost like you were listening to an audio diary.
Yeah, it's interesting, Joel, that on the CD. I know that there are a lot of people that rap, because you see it happening on street corners. You see people do it there's a whole group of like young kids that do it. Obviously in the black community, that's been going on for years. And how did you go about just finding the particular people that had the chops, that you decided had the chops to do a record?
It was in the beginning. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I just went on the internet and was just doing a Google search. I did call a bunch of Army and Marine and Navy bases, and went onto military sites and onto message boards, and Adopt a Soldier programs. Just went all over cyberspace, and someone got in touch with me and said, my son, he's over in Iraq. He's won a few talent shows. And she sent me some video footage of him, and we started a correspondence. And when he returned, I went to meet him and some guys in the 300 Company in the Army, and I went to Fort Riley, and that's where it became a slow domino effect. I learned the whole thing. I learned about the word cipher. I never even knew what a cipher was.
What is a cipher?
A cipher, I'm probably going to sound like a real dumb white Jewish guy trying to make this hip hop glossary. It's a group of people who are it started, I guess, a cipher would be on a street corner.
Right.
People on in a circle,
uh-huh,
just spitting lyrics back and forth.
Okay.
Kind of ad-libbing in the rap lingo. That's what it is. And I learned about that, and that happened. That was just part of training on the Army, Marine bases before, during, and after Iraq. It was just a way of getting through it.
Oh, that's interesting, because there's a way of speaking in the Marines that is almost rhythmic, and that's how they kind of brainwash some of these guys. Well, let's hear one of you can tell me which fellow this is.
Sure.
After we hear his what hip-hop means to him.
Hip-hop, the roots, if you go down to the elements of how it started, we were there to prove something. We were there to say this is how we felt. This ain't for a paycheck. This ain't for us to be known. This is for somebody to understand a soldier's life. And if we're afforded the opportunity to do so through our music, then by God, this is meant for me. We're going to put every damn thing we have into doing it. And that's the end.
Who is that?
That is Sergeant Christopher Tomlinson, a.k.a. Prophet. He's a fantastic. He's the first person I met.
He's the guy whose parents you communicated with?
Yeah, his mother got in touch with me, and then after that I began corresponding with him, and after that I went to meet him and some guys in the 300 Company.
Uh-huh.
And that's where it kind of started to spread out from there.
How many soldiers all in all are involved in the CD? Because it's great, because there's men and women, black,
yeah,
white,
mm-hmm,
Latino. You kind of cover the diversity thing.
Yeah.
I think was important.
Uh-huh. I tried to mix it up. It's funny, if I had everyone I wanted on the CD, it may have been a box set. There was a lot of people who kind of went on deployment. We never saw from them again. It was just a logistical nightmare. So, but on the CD itself, there's about eight. I think we got eight rappers, and then you've got some of the spoken word vignettes.
I believe we're going to call one of the rappers in just a few minutes, but I'd like to listen to a couple other these moments, these interview moments on the CD. This is you can tell me who's talking.
Sure.
In this clip, after talking about rapping, and being in the war and what purpose it serves for them.
The reason people freestyle in Iraq or in a war period, it took their mind off a lot of things, or, you know, we did that. And it was fun. Everybody, you know, came together. We was all unity. It was a lot of camaraderie, you know. We all cared for each other. Those are the times where you actually be with each other 24/7 all day long. So you're going to argue with each other. You're going to talk to each other. You're going to tell each other secrets or, you know, just situations in your life and what you're going through. And the best people to get to know and that you know better are the ones that's out there with you at war.
Now, who's that?
That is Sergeant Keisha Potlard. She just became a sergeant recently. She is in Iraq. She actually called me on the phone 2 weeks ago. I was like, who's this? I was like, what woman is this? She called from Iraq.
Yeah.
And let us know how she's doing, and she's doing well. And, yeah, she's over there on another tour of duty. She does a song on the track called Girl at War, which was done in 6.5 hours in the studio. We never had – every song was done in one day.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah, I can't believe how it came out.
It sounds great. And also, how any had any of them recorded before, any at all?
Yeah, Corporal Mike Watts, a.k.a. Pyro, you know, he did recording down in Houston. Some of them, you know, they really like to rap. It's what they want to do. But Watts actually did some professional recording, and Keisha was on a few verses of some songs, I think, when she recorded some stuff in Nashville. But I'm not sure exactly in what
but none
industry
of them,
level.
Right,
yeah.
Sure. So yeah. We're going to talk to Corporal Watts after this and talk to him in person about rapping and about the rhyming and how it helped him in Iraq and where he's at now. He's stateside, so we're going to get him on the phone. Stay with us. Our guest is Joel Spielman.
Yeah, and I miss him a lot. You know, ain't no way you can bring him back. He sure was. The only thing I got to say about it is I miss him.
From Kuwait to Dwindia, come from the job, all the way from Baghdad, fighting just don't stop. Yeah, we lost some loved ones, God knows we'll see. But none of y'all can understand the things we see. From Kuwait to Dwindia, come from the job.
We're back. Our guest is Joel Spielman, the producer of Voices from the Frontline. What you're listening to now is Don't Understand by Corporal Mike Watts, a.k.a. Pyro. He is on the phone with us. How you doing there, Corporal?
I'm all right.
Well, it's good to talk to you, man. Are you stateside right now?
Yes, I am.
Where you at?
Over on Camp Pendleton, California.
Okay. Now, when you were out there in Iraq... and you recorded the CD. Before you joined the forces, were you aspiring to be a hip-hop artist?
Yes, I was. Like, I've been recording music since I was like 10. Well, not recording, but like been rapping and freestyling since I was like 10.
And when your experience over there, I tell you, I really love this record, and I love the work you did on it. I think there's a type of honesty there that probably even surprised you, didn't it?
Oh, yes, it was.
Because there's an honesty and a raw sense of emotion that really connected with me, because I have no idea what it's like over there, and I don't think many people can unless they've been there. And even if you see pictures of it on television, it's hard to really know. But I'll tell you, the emotion that you guys were able to push through on this CD really captures it in a way that is moving. Now, what was the inspiration for Don't Understand?
Well, everyone knows, whenever I wrote that song in the back of a track, like, we had just got done fighting in the Jaff, and that was while everything, like, last year, August, it was all in the cemetery and stuff like that. Well, not last year, but year before last, in the cemetery, and all the fighting that went on, and I witnessed my buddy dying. And while that had happened, there was a news reporter, I'm not going to say any names or exactly who it was, but news reporter was saying stuff about, like, how he wanted to hurt him, get the story back to the States about, you know, the lives that we had lost.
Yeah.
And that just frustrated the heck out of me. And we was on the track coming back. We had been up for, like, 3 days straight. And the only thing on my mind was, you know, how upset I was and, you know, how no one really understands exactly what goes on, you know, so... I mean, that's where I got the idea from.
So you're saying the news reporter just wanted to get out of there, and he didn't want to report the story or talk to you guys?
No, he wanted to report the story. And what happens is whenever a Marine loses life, they contact the States, people back in the States, and then the Marines back home go to that Marine's house.
Okay.
But he didn't even really try to give them any time to...
Oh, so he didn't care, he didn't take anyone's feelings into consideration, he just wanted the story.
Yes.
Now, I can't even imagine, you know, what that's like, the type of bonds that you guys have to create and the way you take care of each other over there. It must have been just a horrible, powerful thing. Now, do you go back now, Corporal?
Like I said, I get out of the Marine Corps in 60 days today. But depending on how, like, I want to pursue my music career, but depending on what happens, I mean, if, like I said, it all depends on what happens with my music career right now, and see how that takes me, and see how that starts to look as I start to get out. But if not, and I reenlist and find something that I like to do in the Marine Corps, then yeah, I'm definitely going back to Iraq.
So you're not frustrated then with the situation and how things are unfolding?
Oh, no, sir.
Okay. Now, in terms of maybe recording some more from your experience in the war, if you do a record, you think that's what you draw on mostly?
Yes, sir. Most likely, because whenever I rap and the way I rap and what the things I can rap about is totally different from any other rapper out there. I mean, because I have experiences that I don't think any rappers really have right now, so. I mean, I can bring something different to the music industry.
I just had an idea. If you do choose to stay in the Marine Corps, maybe you could infuse some hip-hop in the way they train Marines. Yeah, because there is sort of a rhythmic cadence to you guys when you go through boot camp and stuff. There's a certain I've seen in movies.
That, oh, yes, sir. Our marching cadence and our running cadence.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any way we can hip-hop that up?
I'm pretty sure it is.
Well, yeah, I think that if worse comes to worse, you could at least reinvent the Marines in terms of training. How's that for an idea?
It's a great idea.
All right, Corporal, thanks for joining us. We're going to talk to Joel some more. I really appreciate what you're doing, and stay safe.
No problem, sir. Thank
okay,
you.
Take care. So he sounds like a character. He sounds like a good guy. You know, it's interesting to me, Joel, is that let me make sure people know who I'm talking to and what we're talking about. My guest right now is Joel Spellman. The CD is Voices from the Frontline. We just talked. I did it again.
Spielman.
Spielman.
All right.
That's all right.
All right. The Voices from the Frontline. You know what? It's some sort of karma for us. You know, I get it all my life, and I apologize. And that was Corporal Mike Watt, who we talked to, a.k.a. Pyro, who's on the CD. This is what I found interesting, is that there's a lot of anti-war music coming out now. Neil Young's coming out with a record. Springsteen's coming out with a folk record. There is a momentum in the culture now that is against this war and wants this war to be done. And this is not a protest record. This is not an anti-war record. This is not people in the active military talking negatively about the military. What it is people in the military talking about what they are going through in a war zone. And to me, in the way I interpret that, you can interpret it however you want. There are songs on here about loyalty to the military. There are songs on here that justify the causes that they believe they are in Iraq for. But I still hear it because of my sensibility as an anti-war record. And what were your intentions along those lines?
You know, when we sat down, when I got to meet everybody, I really just simply said, just tell me your life story.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, we never talked politics in the year, about in the year's time that I met everybody. When the brief time we had together, we just sat down and I just said, tell me about your life experiences. And we asked them to bring material that they wrote while they were over there. And when they got to meet each other, some of them had not known each other, or they were different companies. When they got together, they were just talking about their lives over there and just personal issues there. It never got into for the war, against the war. You know, Bush was never mentioned. It was just about what did you do over there? You know, who'd you lose and missing home and so on.